How great is it when you finally come across that item you thought was lost for good? Or how about when you come across a surprise treasure in a place that's completely unexpected? I'm your host, Leah.
I'm Phil.
And I'm Steve. Today we'll be talking about those intriguing discoveries. This is Season 5, Episode 3, Found.
If you have an appetite for the strange and bizarre, then pull up a chair and grab a spoon for another intriguing serving of Remnant Stew. Remnant Stew is gluten-free, organic, made from all natural free-range ingredients and guaranteed to provide the recommended daily serving of curiosity.
Don't you love it when you find something that you thought was lost forever? Have you, either of you ever found anything that you had lost?
I guess car keys don't count, or you know, your wallet, your sunglasses.
Yeah, those are nice. Those are nice finds.
That one beanie you can't find, only, you know, but you find it in the summer when you really wanted it in the winter.
Oh, a beanie? Okay.
I find the things that are lost right after I order another one.
Right.
Right.
That works out too. Yeah. When I was in high school, they were going to tear down a bridge across the river in my town. And so I took a whole bunch of pictures of it. And then, you know, they had them developed in those days with film. And they were in my mom's house. And then many years went by. I kind of wondered where they were. I couldn't find them anywhere. Even when my mom passed, we cleaned out, you know, looked through the house and never saw them. I thought, well, she must have thrown them out or something. So about 3 or 4 years ago, there's a guy in my hometown that has a history blog, and suddenly I saw those pictures on his blog. Evidently, my mom had donated them to the Historical Society and without
How
me knowing
funny.
About it. So
That's
it was
awesome.
Kind of, it was fun to see those again and see that they had, not been lost after all.
Yeah.
I was recently reading about a car dealer who sold a new car to an older couple. They traded in their old car for a new one as a gift to themselves for their upcoming 50th anniversary. While the dealership was cleaning out the older car, they noticed something shiny underneath the molding by the door. With a screwdriver, they managed to fish out a golden ring.
Oh, wow.
The salesman called the couple and told them they had found something in their car that they might want. When they came in, the older gentleman was stunned and overjoyed to see his wedding ring, which had been missing for many years. The newfound ring made their 50th anniversary much more special. We have other stories about found rings later on in this episode.
Well, the whole notion of finding things is appealing to everyone. You might recall our Season 3 episode titled Treasure Hunt.
Oh, that's a good one.
Which detailed many fortunate finds. And there's also many treasure hunts that aren't exactly complete. Complete. So there's treasure out there to be found.
Good luck.
Yeah, if you're interested in that, go back and listen to that episode. And another episode that we did in Season 4 called Outlandish Artifacts describes several of the most unusual archaeological finds from recent years.
Yeah.
Countless bedtime stories, books, and movies detail finding lost treasure, lost items, lost animals, and even lost people.
Yeah.
In our last episode, we featured several prominent items, ideas, and even people who were lost.
Yeah.
Today, it's a little bit more upbeat.
Yay.
This show's all about finding things, many of which were thought to have been lost, and other things which were just previously unknown.
That's right. You do recall our last episode that was called Lost. One of our segments was on movies. We detailed how before 1950, movie film was made of nitrate, which was notoriously unstable and also flammable.
Very flammable.
Very flammable. It's estimated that some 90% of movies made before 1929 have been lost. Many of these were due to fires and storage faults. Originally, many copies of these films were made and distributed in movie theaters throughout the country and around the world. At the end of their run, they were supposed to be returned to the studios, but there was always the chance, and now we would say the hope, that some of those copies of the movies might not have been returned and could still be in the hands of private collectors or stored in some forgotten location. In fact, some movies that were thought to be lost have been found in this way, and that leads us to this happy little segment, movies that were thought to be lost but are now found. According to the Library of Congress website, which is www.loc.gov, in 2014, they learned of the passing of a collector of old movies who was named Al Detlef, who lived in Cudahy, Wisconsin. The manager of the Library of Congress Silent Film Project is a gentleman named Mike Mashon. He arranged to purchase Detlef's entire collection. Well, when it arrived, most of the films turned out to be copies of movies that were already known to exist. But there was one canister that contained something that Mike had only dreamed about. It was the only known copy of the 1910 film Frankenstein.
No way.
Which was produced by the Edison Electronic Edison Electric Company, by Thomas Edison's company. It is thought to be the first Frankenstein movie ever made. It's only 12 minutes long, but it now has been digitally restored, and it is available on the Library of Congress's YouTube channel.
It's alive!
It's kind of flickery, but you can go see it. It's pretty cool looking, actually.
Check it out.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the Library of Congress silent film project, another rare film came their way completely by accident in 2014. One of their employees named Lenan Schweighofer, S-C-H-W-E-I-G-H-O-F-E-R. Anyway, Lenan Schweighofer. She's a moving image preservation specialist, which I think sounds like a lot of fun. That's got to be a really fun job.
That's a lot to put on a business card.
Right. Well, anyway, she got a call from her mother, who lived in a suburb of Worcester, Massachusetts. It happened that an elderly neighbor with no family had died, and Lenan's mother was the executor of this neighbor's will.
Oh, wow.
Well, in preparing the house for sale, Lenan's father had found 8 canisters of movie film in the rafters of the garage. "Send them to me," Lenan told her mother. When the films arrived, Lenan began the process of examining them. She was stunned to find that the films contained newsreel footage of the 1924 World Series between the Washington Senators and the New York Giants. There were scenes from various angles showing base hits and runs being scored, and the last 4 innings were pitched by the Senators' famous hurler, Walter Johnson. The game ended on an infield fly ball. The Senators won the game and the series 4-3, and immediately the fans rushed onto the field. You can see this in the video. Until this film turned up, only a couple of photographs of this game were known to exist. So you can also watch that on the Library of Congress's YouTube channel. And these weren't the only films found stored in odd places. In 2006, a carpenter named Peter Massey was making repairs to an old barn in New Hampshire when he came upon 7 old film canisters. After hauling them around in his pickup truck for a few days, Massey turned the films over to a local college library, which forwarded them on to the Library of Congress. One of the films caused researchers' jaws to drop. It was a 1911 movie called Their First Misunderstanding, starring an 18-year-old actress named Mary Pickford. Now, if you're any kind of a movie buff at all, you might have heard that name, Mary Pickford, because she went on to become a big Hollywood star in the 1920s and 30s. She's one of the founders of the United Artists Studio, as well as the Motion Picture Academy, you know, the ones that put out the Academy Awards. She was right there at the beginning. This was her very first film. In it, Pickford, along with her co-star Owen Moore, portray a young couple having their first argument. Film historian quoted, "It's like finding an early song by George Gershwin or an unpublished short story by Mark Twain. It was really quite an exciting find." Now, there's an article in MovieWeb.com that details several other recently found movies. They include, I like this one, Zept. Z-E-P-P-E-D, Zept. This is a 1916 film starring Charlie Chaplin. It was a 7-minute World War I propaganda film, and in it, Chaplin's little tramp character helps to warn the public about the potential dangers of a Zeppelin attack. The film was found in 2008 in a thrift store in London.
Oh, wow.
Then another one called Outside the Law, from 1920, starring Lon Chaney. Now, that name might be familiar to you because Lon Chaney and then his son, Lon Chaney Jr., were both Hollywood actors, and they often played kind of heavy characters, you know, I mean, the gangsters or monsters of some kind. Well, this was a gangster picture, and it was found in a barn in Minnesota.
Oh.
You might notice that these barns were not in Texas. I think the heat would have caused the film to explode and probably the barn to burn down. Maybe that was the cause of some barn fires.
That's right.
In Texas. Anyway, another one was called Tarzan and the Golden Lion from 1927. This featured James Pierce, who was a well-known actor and also a football player, as the leading man. That film was found in a French hospital.
Okay.
And
that's an odd place to find.
Well, if you think that was odd, this one's even more odd, this final one. The Passion of Joan of Arc, 1928. It was actually a French silent film It was found in a mental hospital in Norway. So who knows what other missing film treasures might be out there. So let's start searching.
Yeah, go look in your attic in your basement.
Exactly.
If you're in the north and northeast.
Yes.
Now, for this next story, we're shifting the direction a bit from finding something that was lost to finding something completely unexpected inside something else.
No, that's always different. Oh,
from no. From history.com and also CNN.com, we learn about a private investor from the Netherlands who purchased a bronze statue from a Buddhist temple in China. While the statue was being carried to a preservation specialist in the Netherlands, workers detected that the statue's weight kind of shifted in an odd way.
Yeah.
So you would think, like, if it's solid,
it's hollow.
The preservationist suspected that there might be something inside the statue. And to confirm his suspicion, he had the statue taken to the Meander Medical Center in the nearby Dutch town of Amersfoort.
Yeah, Amersfoort.
Amersfoort. That's a. It's an easy word to say, but it's a very. It's got a lot of vowels in it.
Amersfoort.
Right. There, the medical staff carefully slid the statue into a full body CT scan.
Why not?
The image on the screen showed the form of a human body in the lotus position, sitting inside the statue.
So there's a statue with a human body
inside it. Yes, yeah. It appears that over 1,000 years ago. Buddhist monks, this is a practice that they had. Buddhist monks in China, Japan, and Thailand developed the unusual practice of self-mummification. Evidently, they believed that this would better prepare them for the afterlife.
If you're already a mummy before you die, get you halfway there. Maybe that's what they were thinking. Okay.
So monks interested in mummification would spend several years eating a special diet of acorns, berries, tree bark, and pine needles. How's that for a diet?
Wow.
Well, I mean, it is trail mix.
Oh, my gosh. They would also drink a poisonous tea made of tree sap that repelled maggots and acted as an embalming agent.
Well, did it repel termites, though?
After years of this strict diet, the monk would be nearing starvation. His fellow monks would bury him in an underground chamber, but give him a bamboo tube to breathe through.
That was nice of him.
He was also given a bell to ring each day to let other monks know that he was still alive.
Okay.
And then, so breathing through the tube, the monk would sit in the lotus position and repeat chants, I guess kind of like bringing him closer and, more spiritual. When the bell stopped ringing, the tube was removed and the tomb was sealed. 3 years later, the monks would dig him up, and if the body had mummified, it was moved to a nearby temple and honored.
So he's eating all this stuff to help him mummify, then he's dead for 3 years, and they dig him up. They see if it really worked.
Yes.
And if it wasn't mummified, they put him back
well, in.
No, here's the thing. This this was a place that they were trying to ascend to.
Right.
And if they were mummified, then they had ascended and reached this this plane. But if they had not, then they didn't do it correctly, or they weren't spiritual enough or something to that nature. So if they were mummified, then they were greatly honored. They were considered very holy and honored.
They must have been living right.
So back at the hospital in Amersfoort, technicians used a specially designed endoscope to retrieve samples of the mummy's body. Studying the CT scan, they also discovered that the mummy's internal organs had been removed. Inside the chest cavity, they found small pieces of paper with Chinese characters written on them. From these, researchers believe that the monk's name was Liaquan.
Yeah.
They believe that he lived about 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
Though historians have long been familiar with the practice of Buddhist monks from that era mummifying themselves in this fashion, this is the first one ever to be found inside a statue. So that was not a common practice.
Right. Yeah.
Or one that we knew about.
Not that we know
anyway.
Of. Yeah.
Carbon dating on the statue placed it from the 14th century. So the monk mummy was already some 300 years old before the statue was even created. Hmm. It's unknown why this particular monk was encased inside the statue of Buddha, but there you go. What a find. Hey, you. Yes, you there listening to this podcast. Have we told you lately just how much we appreciate you? Well, we do so much. And so can we ask for a favor?
It's an easy favor.
If you would, please take just a couple of minutes to give us a review on whatever app you're listening on. It may not seem like a lot, but it really does make a difference.
Yeah, it's all about algorithms, altruisms, Pythagorean theorems, all that techie stuff, which boils down to the fact that it helps other listeners and sponsors find us. So if you enjoy Remnant Stew, it would mean a lot if you took the time to give us a review. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Right. Well, now our next story comes to us from the Institute of Nautical Archaeology and their website, Naughty Cow Arc. Oh, I guess it's Nautical Arc. I kind of like Naughty Cow Arc, but anyway. NauticalArc.org. Leah mentioned our season 4, episode 14, called Outlandish Artifacts. Now, one story in that episode featured Pharaoh Khufu's boat, which is found buried next to the Great Pyramid. It gave evidence of the superior shipbuilding techniques that were used by the ancient Egyptians 4,500 years ago. In fact, they've just opened a brand new museum in Cairo for it. I'd love to go see that. Well, in 1982, a sponge diver named Mehmet Kakir was diving off the Mediterranean coast of Turkey when he stumbled upon what he described as, quote, metal biscuits with ears. Yeah, that'll get your attention, won't it? Exploring a bit further, he realized that he had happened upon the remains of an ancient shipwreck. The ancient wreck had been at the bottom of the sea for so long that much of the cedar had disappeared. But Kakir spotted several ceramic jars as well as hundreds of glass, copper, and tin ingots. Kakir's discovery has come to be called the Uluburun shipwreck. Now, if you're a fan of the letter U, then you really love this word. Uluburun is U-L-U-B-U-R-U-N. You don't find four U's in words very often, do you? But anyway, it's named for the coastal region of Turkey where it was located. Uluburun translates to Grand Cape in Turkish, in case you're wondering. Well, dating to the 13th century BC, it is one of the oldest shipwrecks to ever be discovered. The Institute of Nautical Archaeology spent 11 seasons diving to the site, completing some 22,000 dives. That's a pretty thorough investigation, I would say. They recovered a treasure trove of relics ranging from elephant tusks, hippopotamus teeth, jewelry, and a scarab inscribed with the name of the Egyptian queen Nefertiti.
Oh, wow.
But perhaps the most important part of the find was the cargo, which was still intact.
Wait, none of the things were the cargo?
No, those are items that belonged to the crew.
Wow.
It consisted of ingots of copper and tin in a 10-to-1 ratio. And what do you get when you mix 10 parts copper with one part of tin? Well, the answer indicates the age in which this ship comes from. Bronze.
Oh.
That's how you make bronze.
Bronze, yeah.
Wow. It's the Bronze Age. Researchers have determined that the copper ingots came from Cyprus, so it is likely that this ship was transporting these raw materials across the sea to the Greek mainland, where they would have been worked into bronze products. However, it's unknown if this was a Greek ship. Personal effects from the passengers and crew range from a wide area. Researchers speculate that the ship was a merchant vessel manned by an international crew. Now, we're talking 13th century before Christ, B.C., way back in there. Portions of the ship hull, constructed of Lebanese cedar, were still intact, and similar to the Pharaoh Khufu's boat, this ship had been constructed of individually carved wooden pieces that fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. Quoting the INA's website, close study of the cargo and the hull remains of the Uluburun wreck has provided a special glimpse into the Bronze Age, its material cultures, and aspects of construction, economic exchange, and transportation. It is a unique window into the Bronze Age world of some 3,300 years ago.
Wow.
So very interesting. One of the oldest shipwrecks known to exist.
Wow, that's very interesting. But I am now going to say instead of nautical, it's going to be Naughty Cow.
Naughty Cow.
Well, speaking of shipwrecks.
Let's do it.
I'm just going to say, please don't go find that site.
Yes.
Yeah. Speaking of shipwrecks, back in 2007, Mark Hawley, a professor of underwater, or maybe nautical, archaeology at Northwestern Michigan University, was conducting some underwater research at Lake Michigan's Grand Traverse Bay near Traverse City. This is located on the northern part of Michigan's Lower Peninsula.
Okay.
Hawley was hoping to locate and chart the locations of various shipwrecks.
Right.
Using sonar technology and underwater cameras, he did locate a half dozen or so sunken barges and ships, as well as a Civil War era pier and several cars, but no sign of Jimmy Hoffa.
All right.
But Hawley did find something totally unexpected, which has caused a good deal of excitement. Buried in about 40 feet of water, Holly spotted a circular pattern of large stones arranged like the famous Stonehenge in England. Intrigued by these images, he conducted a personal dive to the site and brought back some remarkable photographs. The stones appear to be deliberately placed in a pattern on the bed of Lake Michigan. Even more exciting was the presence of marks on the rocks that didn't look natural. Okay. Examining the photographs, Holly determined that one rock had the image of a mastodon clearly carved into it.
Wow.
Holly immediately held a press conference detailing the find. He asked for a team of petroglyph experts to come to Michigan to verify the find, but there's a problem with it. The stone is still buried under 40 feet of water. Quoting Holly, "They want to actually see it," he said. "Unfortunately," he added, "experts in petroglyphs generally don't dive, so we're running into a little bit of a stumbling block there."
Most people I've seen like that look a little bit, you know, plump.
If verified, the Traverse City Rock Circle, as it has come to be called, would not be out of place. Other known rock circles have been discovered in Michigan and other Midwestern states, including Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio, Illinois, and Iowa. The fact that the Traverse City site is some 40 feet under Lake Michigan does make this unusual, though, but it can also perhaps help to date the discovery. Mm-hmm. Holly explained that during the last ice age, approximately 10,000 years ago, the level of Lake Michigan was considerably lower than it is today. The Traverse City site would not have been underwater at that time.
Uh-oh.
In addition, mastodon may also still have been in the area then, though they were rapidly becoming extinct at that time.
Right.
This information was in an article from ZMEScience.com from 2017. We haven't been able to locate any further details about Holly's find being verified by petroglyph specialists. And so maybe we can all help. If any of our listeners happen to know a petroglyph expert who can also fit into a wetsuit,
yes.
Please contact Professor Mark Holly at Northwestern Michigan University. We need to get to the bottom of this.
Maybe they make a double X size of a wetsuit.
Just get certified, folks.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Well, 1940 was certainly a turbulent time in Europe, as Germany was on the march, conquering and occupying much of the continent. One afternoon in September of that difficult year, a French teenage boy named Marcel sought some respite from the troubling news by taking a hike with his dog through the hills of the Dordogne region in southern France. Halfway up the hill that rises above the town of Montagnac, what appeared to be an abandoned fox den. Now, as teenage boys are known to do, Marcel began poking and digging around the den when he discovered that it led to what appeared to be a larger chamber. The chamber was too small for him to fit through, so Marcel went home. But 4 days later, on September 12, 1940, he returned with three friends, Jacques, Georges, and Simon, as well as some picks and some shovels and some small lanterns. After enlarging the hole, Marcel was the first to crawl through the opening. He slid down a rocky strewn slope until he came to the bottom of a cavern. Soon the other boys followed after him. With the aid of their small lantern, the boys began walking through the subterranean room that was nearly 100 feet long. Before long, they spotted something unusual. Along the walls were brilliant paintings of fabulous beastly animals. Excitedly, the boys explored the walls of the cave until they came to a black hole leading down into what appeared to be a deeper shaft. Swearing one another to silence, the boys went home, but came back the next day with a coil of rope and a better lantern.
I'm so surprised.
These are my friends, all right. Let's go, boys.
I'm so surprised that boys grow up to be men, like they survive boyhood.
Well, mostly they do. Occasionally they don't, but just. Upon re-entering the cave, they moved toward the black hole. Using the rope and a lantern, Marcel descended into the black hole. At the bottom, he was awed by a stunning painting of a man confronting a bison. The boys decided to tell their teacher, who was named Leon Laval, about their. They told him about their discovery. Taking him to the site, they helped Mr. Laval through the entrance and into the heart of the cave. Of course, he was amazed by the boys' find. He had learned of a noted historian named Henri Briot from Paris, who was taking refuge in the area due to the Nazi invasion. A few days later, Mr. Laval and the four boys led the noted historian on a tour of the cave, and of course, that led to an extensive archaeological exploration of the site that is now known as the Lascaux Cave Paintings. Some 6,000 separate images have been identified, which can be grouped into three main categories: animal, human, and abstract sign. They are believed to be some 15,000 to 17,000 years old. As many of the paintings depict hunting scenes, it has been speculated that the caves may have been the site of religious ceremonies associated with hunting. The paintings were created with red, yellow, and black colors made by compounding various minerals together. It has been nicknamed the Sistine Chapel of Prehistoric Art. Little attention was paid to the Lascaux cave during the war years, but after the war was over, activity at the site dramatically increased. To help fund research, the Lascaux cave was opened to the public in July of 1948. Some 1,200 visitors a day toured the site for the next decade. However, by 1955, researchers began to notice that the paintings were deteriorating at an alarming rate. It was determined that moisture from the tourists' lungs, along with the electric lighting, was changing the environment within the cave. The warm, humid air was facilitating the growth of lichens, mold, and fungus on the walls of the cave. This was doing damage to the paintings. The cave was closed to the public in 1963. They did open a replica of the cave in the 1980s so tourists can get an idea of what it was like. Since that time, restoration work has been attended to the damaged paintings, but the mold has proven to be very difficult to remove. Some areas where the mold was removed show visible signs of damage to the paintings.
Oh, man.
In 2008, authorities closed the cave completely for 3 months. Not even researchers and preservationists were allowed to enter. After that, a single individual was allowed to enter the cave once a week for 20 minutes to monitor the conditions.
Oh, today, it was the kid who originally found it.
I don't know. Today, only a limited number of researchers can enter the cave. Efforts to reverse the effects of the mold damage are ongoing. And information came from history.com and also from the French government website Archaeologie, with an IE instead of a Y, .culture.gov.fr.
With all of our episodes, all of our sources are found in the show notes if any of you want to check that out.
Absolutely can look there.
And now for something completely off topic and off kilter. Brace yourself for the oddity du jour.
Joy Milne of Perth, Scotland noticed that her husband stank. Not an extraordinary discovery, mind you. My wife discovers the same thing constantly. But Joy insisted that her husband wasn't showering properly, angering her poor husband, but ultimately dropping it after some time. After some time, it seemed as if he had just adopted a new scent and she'd have to just get used to it. She took note of the musky aroma, though. It's not something she'd ever smelled before and she couldn't place it. But when her husband, 12 years later, was diagnosed with Parkinson's, they joined a support group of likewise afflicted folks and their families where Joy was inundated with that all too familiar musk.
Wow.
Now, at that moment, she was convinced that she was smelling, that what she was smelling this whole time was Parkinson's. But of course, this is ridiculous. No one can smell a brain disease. That's illogical. But,
well, it's cooking wrong.
Right. Yeah. something's not right there. But Joy maintained that she could, in fact, smell the Parkinson's on her husband and beat herself up about it a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if she had known sooner, her husband may not have suffered nearly as much neurological damage before his diagnosis, thus saving precious time along the path of recovery.
Earlier treatment.
She, with the help of some Parkinson's researchers, put her nose to the test, devising a blind study in which Joy would smell the t-shirts of 6 people afflicted with Parkinson's and 6 without.
Sounds like a good test.
Yeah. The researchers were baffled when Joy correctly identified the 6 t-shirts worn by those with the disease. But Joy had also incorrectly identified one of the control t-shirts as also being worn by someone with the disorder. Still, 11 out of 12 ain't bad, and further study would need to be conducted.
Still pretty impressive.
Yeah, there's definitely something to this. Joy went on with the researchers to attempt to develop a way of diagnosing Parkinson's early and was successful. In 2019, researchers at the University of Manchester announced that they had identified molecules linked to the disease found in the skin swabs that they had taken. The scientists have now developed a test using this information, which will hopefully be adopted by hospitals at scale. But what of that false positive in the blind study? Well, 8 months after conducting that study, the man whose t-shirt Joy incorrectly linked to a Parkinson's patient called the researchers to inform them of his most recent diagnosis.
Wow, she picked it up even before he knew about it.
Right, yes. That's right. He had Parkinson's.
Man, they should hire her out.
You know? Now, I got my info from TheGuardian.com, BBC.com, and SmithsonianMag.com.
That is so cool. That is so cool.
Yeah.
If you don't want to know, don't have her over for dinner.
Yeah.
Okay, well, back to the topic of Found and also the topic of French teenagers.
All right.
You got to ask the question. You know, here in the States, we'd say, hold my beer.
I guess this is hold my
champagne,
wine.
Right.
Hold my champagne. Back in 1981, six French teenagers, a mix of boys and girls this time, snuck into the basement of the Ministry of Telecommunications in Paris. This is such an interesting story.
Yeah.
While poking around, they discovered a cable running through the basement floor and into the famed Paris underground.
Mm-hmm.
They also found a couple of maps detailing the entire system of underground passages. After searching around in the underground for a while, they followed the cable back into the basement and then walked upstairs and exited the building via the front door.
Go out the front door, okay.
That's right. Well, pretty bold. Yeah. With their maps, the teens spent the next several months exploring the many networks of passages that exist below the sidewalks of this beautiful city. The 170 miles of tunnels and catacombs underlying Paris has been featured in numerous movies, including Les Miserables, as well as Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
Yeah, I love that movie, Peabody and Sherman.
I do too.
I love Les Miserables also, but yeah.
These empty spaces are the remains of former quarries from which the city was built. They date back as far as the Roman Empire. Tourists can take guided tours through a very small section of these passages, which include the catacombs.
Right.
Here you can see the skeletal remains of long-past Parisians. Their bones were moved here in the 1700s as the city's cemeteries were becoming too crowded. Mm-hmm. However, since 1955, the bulk of the underground network is posted as being off-limits to the general public, primarily for safety reasons. And that means French teenagers.
Yes.
Yeah, like that works.
Now back to these teens. As they grew up, they continued to be fascinated by the prospects and possibilities of the vast underground space that existed just below their feet. Throughout the 1990s, they were hosting private parties and even live entertainment in various caverns located along the network. The group keeps their individual names secret, but they're collectively known as cataphiles.
Okay.
They sneak their guests through drains and ventilation shafts to prepare underground entertainment areas. I mean, like, these were raves.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Underground raves.
Right.
Of course, you can't keep a thing like this a secret for long. No, soon.
You post that on the social media. It's
well, this was the 90s. Yeah, so,
right.
Yeah. Soon, rumors of the cataphiles and their wild parties began circulating through the city. The police department certainly was interested in finding them out.
Yep.
In fact, one party site, which was brazenly located directly under a maximum security prison, was discovered when a former girlfriend of one of the cataphiles ratted them out.
Oh.
It probably wasn't necessary, as the prisoners may have occasionally heard music coming through the plumbing system.
Probably so.
In 2004, several police officers were on a routine training exercise in the tunnels when they spotted something odd. There was a large tarp with a sign painted on it stating, "Building site, no access."
Oh, that'll get your attention. Yeah.
Behind that, a desk guarded the entrance to a tunnel. A motion-activated closed-circuit TV system recorded the images of anyone entering the tunnel. The system also played a recording of dogs barking loudly, obviously, in an attempt to scare intruders away. The officers followed the tunnel for several more meters until it opened up into a larger cavern, which had been shaped to be like an amphitheater. The floor had been terraced, and chairs were sitting on the various levels. A large screen sat on one side of the room and a video projector on the other. Several VHS-style tapes were stacked on a table, but contrary to what you might think or what the investigators were thinking, they weren't adult films. They were primarily 1950s-era film noir flicks.
Oh, man, I love those.
Right? So this was like a highfalutin kind of thing.
Yeah.
One officer was quoted as saying, "None of these films have been banned. They were not even offensive." So the cavern was complete with professional lighting and sound equipment, as well as three phone lines.
Wow. His phone had been tapped.
A smaller adjacent room had been fitted out like a petite bar and restaurant. There were bottles of whiskey, or quote, there were bottles of whiskey and other spirits behind a bar, tables and chairs, and a pressure cooker for making couscous, the spokesman said.
Wine and couscous, okay.
3 days later, the police returned with representatives from the electric and phone companies to determine where the power and phone lines were coming from, right? I mean, yeah. This was...
The police station.
Right. Or the prison, right. Yeah. They're the just prison. When they arrived, they found that all the cables had been cut and the equipment moved. A note on the floor had this message, quote, do not try to find us. Though they have tried for the past 20 years, police still have no idea who the cataphiles are. And this information came from TheGuardian.com and from UnbelievableFacts.com.
Well, that's a good story. And there's probably the parties are still going on down there somewhere. So much unexplored space. Well, now this story also has a French connection, although not a major one. 4 years ago, my wife and I were in London for a 3-day stay. Now, London is noted as being a very expensive city to visit, and it is. We stayed in a very small Spartan apartment that closely resembled a dorm room. I think I paid $150 a night for that place, too. The shower was so tiny that you had to step outside of it to bend over and pick up any drop soap or other items. Yet for the bargain traveler, there are some wonderful things to do in London for free, and perhaps the best one is the British Museum. This museum is enormous. And I believe that you could spend weeks there and not see everything. In fact, I watched as some London pensioners carried small stools with them to sit on while they read the display placards as they moved from one room to the next. So they were making a whole day of it. Just, you know, let's go sit here and read all these, and then they move to the next one.
So kind of like our Smithsonian.
Yeah, it's very similar. And I think it's very similar to the Smithsonian. One of the things that I was most interested in seeing was in their Egyptology area. Now, of course, this area, as well as other parts of the museum, are somewhat controversial because many of the items in the British Museum were procured during Britain's colonial period when they colonized pretty much the whole world. We can talk about that in another episode, but the item I was most interested in viewing here was the Rosetta Stone. Now, you might be thinking I'm talking about that software that you can buy that helps you learn other languages.
Yeah,
no. That software is actually named after this large piece of rock, which was found in Egypt in 1799.
Right.
In that year, Napoleon had led his army on an invasion excursion to Egypt. Napoleon himself explored the Great Pyramids and other sites. But the most significant result of this adventure was found inside the walls of an abandoned fortress. Helping to shore up the walls was an old road sign. Well, not exactly a road sign, but it was part of a public notice sign that had been erected in Egypt some 2,000 years prior, so 200 or 300 years B.C. The reason the sign is so important to modern Egyptologists has little to do with the message on the sign, but rather that the message was printed in three different languages, Greek, Egyptian Coptic, and Egyptian hieroglyphics. So you see, by the time this sign was located in 1799, the meanings of Egyptian hieroglyphic writings had been lost over time. So all those pyramids and all the great structures in Egypt and hieroglyphic writings on them, nobody knew what they meant.
That's right. They couldn't read any of them.
Couldn't read any of them. So this message written in all three languages allowed researchers to decipher the meanings of hieroglyphic symbols and thus read and understand inscriptions all over ancient Egypt. Mm. I should back up just a bit. I made that sound like it was really a simple task for researchers to make the translation. It was not simple. Dozens of plaster casts of the Rosetta Stone were made and sent to researchers all over the world. And even with that, even with the best minds working on it, it still took about 20 years to fully decipher the meanings of the hieroglyphic writings. But without the Rosetta Stone, we still might be in the dark about the history of ancient Egypt. Thus, it was a very important found item. But wait, I can hear you thinking, I thought you said that Napoleon had found it. Why isn't it in Paris? Well, you see, in 1801, the British defeated the French in Egypt and took the Rosetta Stone home with them. Now, today, both Egypt and France would like to have it back, but the British have said, oh, no thanks, it's nice and safe here, and we will keep it. This information came from BritishMuseum.org and also from AllThingsInteresting.com.
The country of Namibia is located on the Atlantic coast of Africa, just north of South Africa. It's one of the most sparsely populated countries on Earth. Yeah. It's larger than Texas, but the population is only about 2.5 million, or 10% of the population of Texas. It's primarily a desert country.
Right.
However, in 1908, a German explorer found a diamond on the ground near the Atlantic coast. Further, German explorers came and set up a diamond mining operation, which helped to fund the German military during World War One. Hmm. Today, Namibia can never say that. Namibia. Namibia is an independent country, but diamonds are still mined in the area. The diamond company De Beers still co-owns the area of that original find, and along with the Namibian government, operates a diamond mine there. But CNN.com reports that in 2008, workers at the diamond mine found something else. Hmm. Using a bulldozer to clear an area, the workers scraped up a mass of metal, wood, pipes, and gold coins.
Wow.
An archaeologist was called in as further scrapings turned up more gold coins as well as a 500-year-old musket. Hmm. The archaeologist... All of a sudden, I can't speak. The archaeologist named Dieter Noli suspected that the miners had happened upon a shipwreck, but not just any shipwreck. He suspected that this was the famous lost Portuguese ship called the Bom Jesus, as is how it's spelled.
Bom Jesus.
Or Good Jesus. Of course, it's not. When they say Bom, it's
Jesus.
Bom,
yeah, probably.
Yeah.
It's Bom Jesus.
I think it's Jesus. Bom Jesus. Okay. Or Good Jesus. In the 1930s, the Bom Jesus had set sail from Portugal headed for India. On board, it had a cargo of tin, ivory, and 22 tons of copper ingots, as well as a chest full of gold coins from Portugal and Spain. Hmm. The ship never arrived in India and has been considered lost at sea. So how did it get up on land? Noli suspects that the coastline was shaped differently in the 1500s than it is today, and he surmised that an Atlantic storm may have blown the ship eastward, causing it to crash onto the land. The crash would have caused the ship's cargo, as well as its masts and decking, to lurch forward. The stormy waves may also have caused a surge, which would have pushed the crashed ship further up onto the land. Okay. The shipwreck site is in the area controlled by the De Beers Company, and their guards have secured the area. Efforts to search the site have been coordinated by the Namibian government, the Portuguese government, and an archaeological team from Texas A&M University. Go Aggies. It has not yet been determined what will happen to the cargo, but the Portuguese government issued a statement that expressed the hope that a museum could be built to display the ship's remains as the treasure. The Bom Jesus is thought to be the most valuable shipwreck ever located.
Wow.
That's interesting. Crazy.
Pretty interesting.
Hey, but you don't need anybody to have to learn how to get, scuba dive.
That's right. That's right. It's not underwater.
It's all good.
Put the ship right up on the land. That made it more convenient. Yeah.
Walk on in.
We have been doing Remnant Stew podcasts for several years now, and we love our listeners. And it's our passion to share crazy and bizarre stories with you. Our continuing goal, however, is to increase our listenership and share our stories with an even larger number of people.
That's right. But growing a podcast audience takes a lot of time and energy. That's where you can help us out. Studies have shown that overwhelmingly, word of mouth is the best promotion tool for the growth of a podcast.
That's right.
So we're asking you to please share Remnant Stew with your friends. Pick out a favorite episode and pass it along.
Right.
We would really appreciate it. And thanks so much already for the support that you've given us. We love you guys.
We really do.
Very much so.
Okay, as promised earlier, now we're going to get to some stories about people who have lost things and then found them much later. Perhaps this has happened to you. These come to us from an article on BoardPanda.com titled 50 Unbelievable Stories of People Finding Things They Thought They'd Lost Forever. Unfortunately, they didn't include any names, so we don't know for certain whether these stories are true or not.
So they forgot the names. They'll find them later.
That's right.
Don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. That's one of our mottos here at Remnant Stew. So here goes. Oh, and we are going to cover all 50 of these unbelievable stories. Just the most interesting ones, because frankly, about 40 of them were pretty lame. But anyway, here goes the first one. A fisherman at a lake in Austria lost his wallet in 1997. In 2007, he was 2017, he was fishing this lake again, and you guessed it, he fell in the lake and drowned. No, no, wait, that's the wrong story. I got that mixed up the wrong line here. Here's what happened. He was pulling up one of his nets, and his wallet was part of the debris at the bottom of the net. It had been in the lake for 20 years, still sitting there.
Wow.
A woman lost her wedding ring in 1995. Then in 2011, she was pulling up carrots in her garden. She saw something shiny encircling one particular carrot. Upon further examination, she discovered that it was one of her spoons. No.
It was her husband's ring.
Yeah, that's right. It was actually her wedding ring that had been in the ground for 16 years.
I had seen that story. Yeah, I'd read that story.
Oh, but wait, there's more. Another man lost his wallet in the Atlantic Ocean. I'm glad they were really specific about where he lost it in this article. Atlantic Ocean in 1993. A Good Samaritan found it and returned it to him in 2017. They didn't say what area.
Oh.
It was somewhat deteriorated, but his student ID was still intact. Good old lamination. In 1986, a man bought a ticket to see Prince live in concert.
Hey.
Before the concert, he lost the ticket and he couldn't go. In 2015, he found the unused ticket in the back of a book, which is, you know, maybe you shouldn't use recreational drugs when you are trying to hide a ticket.
Oh, listen to that. Listen.
It was called Advil, I swear.
But he might be able to sell that as a
keepsake of somehow.
That's right.
And the next one, an 82-year-old man lost his wedding ring. He later found it when he pulled up a carrot in his own garden. The ring was encircling the carrot and had caused a large dent in it.
What is it about carrots?
Rings and carrots, yeah.
Okay.
A woman lost a very special earring while traveling overseas. She spent several hours searching for it to no avail. A couple of months after she returned home, she found the earring embedded in the sole of her sneaker.
And that made...
I can really believe that one.
I can too. I just can't believe that it made, like, somebody wrote about it.
Or
like,
that it didn't go off in the metal detectors between getting on and off the airplanes.
I don't know. A different woman lost her wedding ring in 2004. She found it in 2017 in her vegetable patch. And you guessed it, it had a carrot growing through it.
Getting a little outrageous.
Another different woman lost her class ring in a river in Virginia. At least they specified that one a little bit more. In 1983, recently, a Good Samaritan found the ring and through her high school was able to track her down and return the ring. That was nice. I lost a ring in my classroom ring in a river, but nobody's found it yet either.
Or maybe they have and they just didn't.
Well, they might have kept
it.
That's true. Yeah. A still different ring lost her purse in a lake in 1993.
Let's start over again.
Okay, that's cool.
A still different woman lost her purse in a lake in 1993. 25 years later, a boy snagged it with his fishing line, and he managed to return the purse to her. It still contained credit cards, photographs, lipstick, and eyeliner.
That's a good purse.
Yeah. And finally, a man lost his wedding ring in 2002. 15 years later, he found it in his garden. Can you guess where?
On a potato.
Actually, it was around a piece of bamboo this time, so not a carrot. Those, again, come to us from boardpanda.com.
That's funny.
What's up with finding them with carrots?
With carrots, I know. And the bamboo, though, like, bamboo grows tall. Where did he find it? Like at ground level or way up?
And quick.
That's right.
It's not like it's a slow grower so much.
Yeah.
That's funny. We have brought you quite a variety of found stories today. In fact, we thought we were done. That is until we saw this headline from elitereader.com. The headline is Drunken Couple. Don't you love anything? Any headline that starts with drunken couple.
Hey, baby, hold my beer.
Drunken couple finds chapel under their house. You can't just make it up.
Right.
Pat and Diane Farla own a Victorian home in Telford, England. When they bought the home in 2014, they noticed a rectangular metal grate in the hallway near the front door. They always assumed that it had something to do with the ventilation system. That's the first thing I would...
Yeah, what's under there?
See what's there.
I would. But then one weekend in 2017, They had been celebrating.
French rave. Oh, wait, sorry. It's England.
Yeah.
They've been celebrating their time off with some adult beverages, and actually quite a few adult beverages. Uh-huh. Thus emboldened with liquid courage, they decided to lift up the grate and have a closer look. All they saw was ground, but then it looked like there was a passageway under the kitchen. Pat and Diane were too large to fit into the passageway, so they persuaded their skinny nephew, Gareth, who had also been celebrating, to shinny down the hole and take a look.
Come on, Gareth, into the who?
What Gareth found was a small chapel.
That's cool.
Chapel had been reinforced with bricks and had a curved ceiling. Brick pews were placed along the sides. A wooden cross was laying on the floor. It appeared to have once been attached to the end wall before falling down. Another article in dailymail.co.uk about Pat, Diane, and Gareth quoted a local historian named Richard Brooks, who believes that he knows what the chapel was for.
Hmm.
As the house was built in the late 1700s, Brooks believes that the chapel may have been a clandestine Catholic church. Quote, it was illegal at that time to be Catholic. If you were found out, you could be persecuted or even executed.
That makes sense.
It also may have been what's known as a priest hole, unquote. Mm-hmm. We mentioned priest holes during our season 3 episode titled Once Upon a Time, as they played priest holes played a role in popular fairy tales from that time.
Yeah, that was our fairy tale episode. Then I remember.
Yeah, that's one of our most popular episodes. But priests, a lot of homes had just little hidey places for priests so that they wouldn't be found. Brooks also surmised that the chapel may have been used as a bunker during World War II.
Probably.
Rotting wooden crate was also found in the chapel. It contained newspapers and other items dating from the 1930s. Other than showing off the chapel, maybe they should have found some. It would have been cool if they found some film.
Yeah. Right.
Other than showing off the chapel to some news media and a few curious neighbors, Pat and Diane have no plans to utilize the chapel other than perhaps for storage. The family is a bit superstitious.
Wine cellar.
Quote, we didn't like to touch the stuff too much, unquote. Said, that was a quote by Gareth. So the nephew that was skinny shimmy down in there. So that would be amazing to just pull up a grate in your floor and find
something from 300 years ago that'd been purposely made like that. That's a pretty interesting thing.
All right, folks, remember to check out our Facebook and Instagram pages at Remnant Stew Podcast. Drop us an email at staycurious@remnantstew.com just to say hi, or to let us know about any topic you would like to hear us cover in an upcoming episode.
Remnant Stew is a part of Rook and Raven Ventures, and it's created by me, Leah Lamp. Steve Meeker researches and writes each episode that we then host together. Our audio producer is Philip Sinkfeld. The oddity du jour is brought to you by Sam Lamp. Theme music is by Kevin McLeod, with voiceover by Morgan Hughes. Special thanks goes out to Judy Meeker. And for a complete list of sources on this episode, please see our show notes.
Now, before you go, please hit the follow button so you won't miss an episode. Head on over to Apple Music and leave us a review. We really love reading those reviews. Share Remnant Stew with your friends, your family. If you happen to know of a scuba diving petroglyph expert, share it with him. Until the next time, remember to choose to be kind and always stay curious.